For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. Tonight we're going to have a Sangha talk, a member of our Sangha, Jim Spiegler, who's our librarian and has helped organize our library, and is a long-time student of the way, will be speaking. So, Jim, thank you very much.
I'm used to talking, but not into this stillness. All of you, this Sangha, this Zendo, are my grounding in Zazen. Your silence, your straightness around me, hold me up, keep me focused as much as I can be. I'm grateful to each of you. I will bring you a few texts, a few voices from outside Zen tradition that bring me closer to some elements in Zen teaching and practice. As usual, they're open to response and discussion. Along the way, I may be saying a few things about me, that is my experience, that is my practice. A footnote here, this is embarrassing. I seem to have been particularly distracted in putting this together. I chose passages which I love, but when I reread them today, some of them don't seem to say what I thought they did. Bear with me, please. I left them in anyway. Emptiness. This is a poet which Tygon has quoted, and many other people. This is Rumi. 13th century, actually a contemporary of Dogen, a Sufi poet, Persian, I think, or African. Praise to the emptiness that blanks out existence. Existence, this place made from our love for that emptiness. Yet somehow comes emptiness, this existence goes. Praise to that happening, over and over. For years I pulled my own existence out of emptiness. Then one swoop, one swing of the arm, that work is over. Free of who I was, free of presence, free of dangerous fear, hope, free of mountainous wanting, the here and now mountain is a tiny piece of straw blown off into emptiness. These words I'm saying so much begin to lose meaning. Existence, emptiness, mountain, straw. Words and what they try to say swept out the window, down the slant of the roof. There's one here which I'm just throwing in, despite the specific Christian cast, because I think it's neat and Zen-worthy in connection with the falling away of self. This is Angelus Silesius, 17th century, I think he was Protestant and Catholic by turns. God, whose love and joy are present everywhere, can't come to visit you unless you aren't there. in the area of immediacy, shifting perspectives, intense focus on the moment. There's Kukai, 9th century, a Buddhist monk, though not a Zen one. A hand moves, and the fire is whirling, takes different shapes. All things change when we do. The first word, ah, blossoms into all others. Each of them is true. And shifting perspectives, consuming and insoluble problems. This is an everyday one. They may still be there, but in a moment are eclipsed by something else, perhaps by something small and close. Sliver of your thumb. Something minor cropping up, but close up. Or not so small. Shifting perspectives turn on a dime. For one moment, ordinary consciousness. This was about 3 weeks ago. Ordinary dispersion, obsession with or stewing about future problems, predicaments. This was while my wife one evening seemed kind of sick and feverish, but took her temperature, there was no fever. Somebody came along who knew more about it. This is a useful thing, I think, to remember. Don't necessarily go by oral temperature. She suggested checking axillary temperature under the arm. 103. You snap into focus. And choices and action in the next 2 minutes. Those shifts are continuous. What's important, what isn't, and especially what's immediate. 9-1-1. She's back, she's fine. Compassion, which is the most difficult for me. It's difficult in the area of opening my heart to others, actively responding to their needs. In preparing this talk and thinking about my compassion deficit, I was drawn for a moment to beat myself up publicly, perhaps in order to display to myself and you my seriousness and heartfelt intention. Stepping back, I noticed my self-importance. And a lack of compassion towards my limited, insufficient self. One of the most important teachings I ever received was in a practice in Ryudokusen with Norman Fisher longtime abbot of Zen Center and an old friend. And I was laying out for him a contrast between how long I had been sitting and how little progress I'd made. And he gave me my three words. Compared to what? These kind of judgments are a form of clinging to self. And it's good to keep a sense of continually shifting perspectives, which can otherwise be phrased as a sense of humor. Tigan asked me originally, he said I had a choice of what we should chant. And I didn't think twice. I said the Song of the Grass Hut. I love those images in that situation. I can see it as a painting. And so, incidentally, Tiger told me tonight that it wouldn't actually work out because of the circumstances. There was a memorial chant. But looking at the Song of the Grass Hut, supposing it was going to be chanted today, that's one of the ones that I found wasn't saying what I thought it said. Where it says, who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? What I remembered was more or less the opposite. That is, being a host. Being a host to oneself. Being the guest, being the host. I thought it made sense. Maybe it's in some other chant, but it's not in that one. Anyway, I thought it made some, what I thought was in it, I thought made some sense in terms of hosting oneself, treating oneself with the attention and the forbearance which one accords to a guest. My final text is from a 19th century English novel. A big 19th century English novel, both in terms of pages and in terms of esteem. It has been called the greatest novel in English. On the order of War and Peace, but and large and peopled with many people, a people with many characters, and full of insights into people and life. But it's set in a country town, a market town, and they're much more ordinary people and events. And so there are these vast stretches of life, dialogue, things happening to people along the way. And then right in the middle of it, it breaks out into another dimension. Once. The scene, the image, is of a young woman weeping on her honeymoon. She is married on the basis of who she thinks her husband is and what her life will be. And she got it wrong. Some discouragement, some faintness of heart at the new, real future, which replaces the imaginary, is not unusual, and we do not expect people to be deeply moved by the very fact of frequency. I'm sorry, back a bit. We do not expect people to be deeply moved by what is not unusual. That element of tragedy which lies in the very fact of frequency has not yet wrought itself into the coarse emotion of mankind. And perhaps our frames could hardly bear much of it. If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heart beat. And we should die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence. Among other things, I think, and perhaps you think of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva who hears the cries of all the suffering in the world. To do that, obviously, you need more than a human frame. And so that's where I get to be here. And it's you, I hope, for discussion and response. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Wonderful images, wonderful. I want to thank you particularly for talking about compassion deficit and our own compassion deficit, and what a compassionate thing to consider, and to consider it for ourselves. So anyway, thank you for all of that offering. Our responses, questions for Jim, comments, please feel free.
You're kind of working with negative self-clinging and the kind of impulse to admit one's stuff, mistakes, or confess, you know, kind of publicly. And it reminds me of, like, you know, I've seen in practice, and maybe some of you have seen this too, where often people will publicly confess, you know, like, the Dalai will say something like, oh, I forgot to put the charcoal in at the correct angle. I apologize for that. You know, or the Kokyo will say something like, oh, I apologize for omitting the chant, you know. And I kind of wonder about that. Like, a lot of times you're kind of admonished, like, oh, that's so selfish of you to do that. But there's also something kind of nice about it. Admitting one's faults and sharing that with the Sangha. So, you know, I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but I just think it's such a deep question, because I used to like be kind of annoyed going, who's that person just confessing? But then I'm sort of like, you know, we kind of need to do that for a while. Maybe like, you know, first, I don't know, maybe for me, maybe first 60 or so years of my life, I'm still not done with it. But, you know, I wonder how that is for you, like where you find that balance and how that works for you, you know, making that decision. What helps?
I think confession is a good word. But I guess the examples you gave seem like easier things to confess. I made a mistake. Not necessarily that out of jealousy and hatred of the Sangha, I did certain things which harmed the ceremony or whatever. Mistaken actions, blunders, seem light to me, and they don't take any skin off oneself or other people. I think offering what one is, what one isn't, and inviting shame or commiseration, pity, contempt, whatever. This is another order of confession, and more complicated, and proverbially it's good for the soul, and in some ways it is, and in ways that I guess I was trying to indicate, in some ways it isn't, even when you're confessing to yourself. Especially when you're confessing to yourself.
I'm moved by your topic, and I'm trying to feel how to frame it for us. I feel like you're talking about what is true, you know, in various words, honesty, maybe integrity, maybe uprightness, how to take care of the fallibility of this person. And I appreciate that you brought in not quote unquote Zen, you know, Kukai is pretty close. But anyway, I just feel some depth and how do we be true to something that is, that this self fails at?
I liked that a lot, the idea of the grass growing
Because we talk about the grass growing as the... I can't remember which sutra that's out of either, but the bodhisattva's coming up.
Oh, out of the ground, out of the earth, like the Lotus Sutra. Yeah,
the Lotus Sutra. And so I was kind of thinking about that when you're talking about the grass growing too. Just ordinary. But I thought that your talk was very sweet. And I thank you, because I've never heard you talk before, formally.
Only in the car.
In the car.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And yes, this grass growing is in this spirit of the simplicity, the everydayness of Zen, nothing special. Sitting quietly, the grass grows on its own. Or there's a line that my teacher read, used to quote, that sitting quietly, a flower blooms in the back. So to be sensitive to the complexity of this self, as you have expressed for us, is maybe the fruit of just being willing to sit and be present and be ourselves. And citing literary sources is a nice way of, in some sense, letting go of our own words and just, okay. Anyway, I just am feeling appreciation for that.
Jim, over here, can you hear me all right? You spoke of shifting perspectives and sort of the importance of that, and talked about humor as well. I'm wondering which, with the ease of the mind to do this, which ones do you hold on to?
If I have paid attention all these years, none. On the one hand, it's misguided to try, and on the other hand, you're not going to be able to do it. They shift by themselves. You, at best, you struggle to keep up. Or draw back a bit and watch them. Observe them and take in some way the shifts. I think, translated by Stephen Mitchell. Incidentally, this is my crib. The Enlightened Heart, it's an anthology edited by Mitchell. He didn't do all the translations, but he did a number of them, and his ear chose the others. Angelus Silesius, four short lines. God, whose love and joy are present everywhere, can't come to visit you unless you aren't there.
Well, that sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
It's almost like a haiku almost, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just and I think that it's interesting to meet someone in a very different tradition who has a similar view about the whole idea of dropping off self and forgetting the self to find Buddha or to find the encounter of the Godhead. That's very familiar.
Sure. It does. I don't think of them as very different traditions. Further down you go, the more different they are. But on the way up to the mystical level, mystical thought, mystical experience, there's a tremendous convergence. I think we mystics can have a common language. They can talk to each other. Pretty effectively, I think.
I think if nothing else, they surely have a pretty common understanding of self and how it can get in the way and fool you.
Entirely. Maybe I should have added not talking to each other. They're unanimous about the best you can do is talk about what can't be talked about. The great thing about it is that the talk that does come out is so often so charged and so beautiful. All these efforts at trying to do the impossible.